Today is Thursday, October 19th. We'll begin the digestive system today.
Okay. So, you know, we were almost done with respiratory in class on Tuesday, so we want to finish up here how carbon dioxide is transported. So on the bottom of page 80, you'll notice that we're looking at carbon dioxide and internal respiration. So this is the time when carbon dioxide is loaded into the bloodstream. So we are making CO2 as a result of cellular respiration. Mitochondria make CO2 to make ATP. And we load that carbon dioxide along a pressure gradient into the bloodstream. So what kinds of vessels do we load CO2 into? Capillaries, yeah. Are they pulmonary or systemic?
Systemic.
Yeah, they're systemic, good. And so, of course, we load those carbon dioxide molecules along a pressure gradient from high pressure in our cells to lower pressure in the capillaries. And when carbon dioxide gets into the bloodstream, it actually transforms into a bicarbonate ion for transport. So it's not that we're transporting bubbles of carbon dioxide gas. I don't want you to think that we have like champagne-like blood. We don't have bubbly blood, but instead we have carbon dioxide transported as a bicarbonate ion in the bloodstream. That bicarbonate ion is how CO2 is transported. And then when we get back to the lungs, that chemical reaction runs in reverse, and we now have a gaseous form of CO2, and we exhale that out at the alveoli of the lungs. So, you know, if your respiratory system cannot handle exhaling and getting out that CO2 from your bloodstream, what other system can handle bicarbonates for you?
Your urinary system.
Yeah, kidneys, urinary system, good. So, kind of cool that we have two systems at play, a balance there for acid-base, and we do have a backup system in case we can't handle CO2 for the respiratory. So the main way of transporting carbon dioxide is, in fact, as a bicarbonate ion. We also can transport some of it bound to hemoglobin molecules. We call it carbaminohemoglobin. It's kind of a fun one to say. And the point is that the carbon dioxide doesn't necessarily bind the same seat that is traveled by an oxygen molecule. So there's no competition, no direct competition there for transport. And then some of our CO2 is also transported in the blood plasma. So we've got mostly, we're carrying it as a bicarbonate ion. And that was it. Anything I can go back and review for you? Oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve, pulmonary ventilation, respiratory control. Too hot? Okay. If y'all get too hot, who knows?
Do you have any review questions?
I do on D2L, their respiratory gas control or respiratory rate control problems and more oxygen hemoglobin curve problems. Well, I'm going to let you guys study on that a few days, and then if you want to hit it Tuesday with the review, we can do that. Or next Thursday. Yeah, just let me know. We can hit that. Okay. All right, so you see there's some really big, meaty topics in the respiratory system, you know, and then the digestive system is just a lot of organs. So we're going to start off with just an overview to the digestive system, talk about the main functions here, and then we're going to dive into what each organ contributes to the process of digestion and absorption. If you think about each organ in that way, you know, how is it structured? What does it contribute to digestion and absorption? I think that will help you keep straight all the processes that take place here. All right, so let's start off by defining digestion and absorption. Which of these is a breakdown process?
Digestion,
good. If you're doing, say, mechanical digestion, what is an example of that?
Chewing.
Chewing, Yep, so chewing is mechanical. What your stomach does in churning up food, that's also mechanical. And then we also have enzymes, acids, and bases that help us break down food particles, but we call that chemical digestion. And so thinking way back into Bio 210, you probably talked about two kinds of reactions, dehydration synthesis and hydrolysis. Which one of those two is a breakdown reaction?
Hydrolysis,
good. All right, so this is digging back in your brain. When you break down polymers into monomers, how do you break apart those polymers?
Water.
Yeah, that's it. So we actually have to add water to those polymers to break them apart. And you know, sometimes in this case with digestion, we use enzymes to help break apart those polymers into monomers. Acids can also help do some breakdown as well. So I just want to emphasize, when we talk about chemical breakdown, we're actually talking about hydrolysis, literally assembling a polymer into the building blocks or the monomer. Okay, and so I'll try to repeat that as we go through so we keep our focus on the actual chemical destruction of those food particles. You know, once you get these food particles into a small enough form, they can be absorbed. They travel across the wall of our digestive tract and into what?
The
bloodstream, right. So do you happen to know the organ that is primarily absorbing nutrients for us? Good, small intestine, good. So we talked about the digestive tract. We can also call it the alimentary canal. It seems kind of like an older term. We also can call it the GI tract, short for gastrointestinal tract. And the primary organs that are belonging to that GI tract are the ones through which food will directly travel. This is pretty easy. You probably have known this since you were in maybe elementary or middle school. We know that food travels from the mouth. We swallow through the pharynx region. It travels down a pipe known as the esophagus into what organ?
Stomach.
Good. We'll talk about the four regions of the stomach that food travels through, and then it travels into which of the intestines?
Small.
Good. From the small intestine, we travel into the large intestine, and then the exit route takes us into the rectum and the anus, and then to the exterior of the body. So we'll add a little more detail as we get further into those organs and their structures. The accessory organs are ones that don't directly have food traveling through them, but rather contribute something to the process of digestion. And going back to our picture here, what are some of the accessory organs in your mouth?
Teeth.
Salivary glands,
tongue,
a lot in the mouth, right? Okay, let's see, down in the lower digestive area, we have
gallbladder, liver,
pancreas, good. Which one? Okay, so we've got several accessories there, so we've got a lot to contribute to the process of breaking down the food. Those accessory organs often help digest the food, either mechanically or chemically, but they may or may not be involved in that absorptive process. Let's talk about the four layers of your GI tract. Let's start on the innermost layer. We call it mucosa. Back when you guys studied membranes in Bio 210, you probably talked about a mucous membrane. And in fact, the mucous membrane lines our digestive tracts from the mouth to the anus. So when we're talking about mucosa, we're simply implying that there is a mucus, a very moist membrane that lines that digestive tract. Why do you think it's important that we don't keratinize the inside of our digestive tract?
Because you need water to break down and absorb.
You need water to break down, you need water for absorption.
It'd be very hard to get food to flow through.
Yeah, could you imagine?
Like trying to eat salting crackers.
Yeah, like eating salting crackers with a dry mouth, yeah.
You get choked.
Seriously choked, yeah. And worse yet, if you're trying to have a bowel movement with a dry rectum, imagine that. So, yeah. You came at the right time for this conversation, right? Yeah. So, very good reason to have those goblet cells in that mucosa lining. Helps to make moist mucus to help lubricate the passage of food. And you're right, it helps us absorb food, break down food. We don't need a dry, keratinized mucosa lining for our digestive system. Okay, so you'll notice there that mucosa secretes mucus, absorbs nutrients, protects against infection. You know, we often think about mucus in our nasal cavities being good to trap bacteria, but it's also in our digestive tract to trap bacteria there as well. So what layer is next in terms of going out toward the outside?
Submucosa,
good. What types of things will you find in the submucosa?
Glands.
Elastic fibers.
Good.
Nerves.
Blood vessels, elastic fibers, nerves.
Autonomic nerves,
good. Okay, so autonomic means?
The involuntary system,
good. So these digestive organs are controlled by an involuntary branch of your peripheral nervous system. You know, we've got parasympathetic and sympathetic that we'll talk about one more time in terms of how these systems operate. All right, and then we've got a mucosa external layer. I'm sorry, muscularis external layer. And of course, that's just a fancy way to say that we have muscles in our digestive tract. Most of our digestive tract has a circular ring of muscles and a longitudinal layer of muscles. The stomach is the only one to have a third extra layer of muscles. That's for the grinding potential that we need to have going on there. But most of the time what we see is an inner circular layer and an external longitudinal layer of muscles. Looks something like this. You can see here our circular muscles, and then an outer ring of longitudinal muscles, okay? And so if you think about how you operate a tube of toothpaste, that's how these muscles operate. Sometimes the muscles will squeeze like you do a tube of toothpaste, and then they'll relax and let the food pass through, and then they'll squeeze again. And then, of course, those longitudinal muscles are like taking your tube of toothpaste, lay your hand at one end, and then milk it toward the other end. So when you look at a picture like peristalsis, these muscles contract and relax in order to milk that food along to your next organ. So a concept that we call peristalsis and propulsion is going to rely on those operational muscularis externa muscles. All right, and then finally we've got a serosa layer, which is actually serous membrane. So we've actually hit two of our membranes today. What type of tissue makes up serosa?
Simple squamous.
Simple squamous, good. And of course, it's very, very thin layer of tissue. We do have an innermost layer of serosa that we call the visceral layer. And the visceral layer wraps on the outsides of your organs. You'll notice in this picture there are blood vessels traveling through that serosa. I kind of imagine in my mind that the serosa is like a layer of saran wrap that wraps around your organs and traps a set of blood vessels between those layers. So if you were to look at, say, the intestines and the stomach, the serosa, the visceral serosa, actually covers those organs directly. Where would we look to find the parietal serous membrane? Yeah, the cavity. So if you were to peel back the abdominal cavity wall, the shiny stuff that's attached to it would be your parietal serous membrane or your parietal serosa. Now, we have an alternate name called mesentery that describes your visceral peritoneum, and so that's just another name for it. It's just that thin layer that covers and wraps directly around your digestive organs. Let me clarify here, we're talking about digestive organs below the diaphragm. So there is, in fact, no serosa covering your esophagus and certainly none on your mouth and your pharynx. So we're really talking about what's sitting below your diaphragm, stomach, intestines, liver to some extent. So those organs have this visceral peritoneum covering them. It is, and I don't think everybody realizes until they open it up that there's all those intestines hooked together. Mm-hmm. They're not just laying there like hose. Yep. Just wanted to mention, it's kind of a side issue here. You know, sometimes people have an appendix rupture, and the appendix normally contains a bunch of bacteria, which is bad enough if it ruptures. When that appendix ruptures, it can travel throughout your peritoneum and cause a condition that we call peritonitis. So unfortunately, that means now the infection spreads from a localized appendix on the lower right side now can cover the outsides of all your digestive organs below the diaphragm. I had a student years ago in class. Her husband had an appendix rupture, but unfortunately it was far worse than bacteria. It was cancer cells. Mm-hmm. Those cancer cells spread over the peritoneum, and all these digestive organs, liver, stomach, intestines, had cancerous tumors form on the outside surface. Mm-hmm. He went through, she was in my class, and he went through numbers of surgeries to have those tumors removed. And he passed away after like 2 hard years of battling that cancer. And if I remember correctly, he was something like 44 or 45 years old. So certainly something to be aware of when that appendix ruptures, you know, can be very dangerous. All right, so that takes us to the bottom of the page. Just a couple of terms down there. We'll talk about most of those functions as we go through the next several pages. Maybe some of these are new, things like ingestion, mastication, peristalsis, so on. So we'll talk about those as we discuss each organ that it applies to. What kind of questions do you have on this first page? Ashley. I just know the ones I hit on. I just know them in order from inside to out or outside to in. Because oftentimes in the test, I ask you guys to put them in the correct order.
Okay.
What?
What's that?
Just the fourth tissue. Like mucosa, submucosa, muscularis, externa, and then serosa from inside out, or vice versa. Okay, so I just want to repeat, when you come upon an organ, what you want to think about is how is it structured, what does it contribute with its structure to digestion and absorption. We know the mouth does no absorption, and so that means the only functions here are really breaking down food, starting the digestive process. Let's go over the structures first. In your worksheet there, you'll notice the mouth is also known as the oral cavity. It is lined on the inside with a moist mucous membrane. We have lips that form the anterior surface. We have cheeks that form the lateral walls of our mouth. We have a hard palate and a soft palate that divides your mouth from your nose. Which one of those two is made up of bone, like maxilla and palatine? Hard palate. Good. And the soft palate toward the back, no bone there, but there is a dangly uvula at the back that helps to seal off your nasal cavity if you happen to cough, if you swallow. That keeps food from traveling up into that nasal cavity. All right, so the point of having a palate is to keep food and mucus and air in your nasal cavity separated, so we don't want to have food and mucus mixing together, or we don't want your cleaned air being mixed with food in your mouth. So that's one very good reason to have a palate separate the two. What's another reason to have the palate between the mouth and the nose? Yeah, so you don't shove food when you're chewing up in there. What else? Snot in your food. You push your tongue to the roof of your mouth when you chew, when you talk. Even when you swallow, you push your tongue to the roof of your mouth. And talking would be very difficult if you did not have a palate separating mouth from nose.
So it's going
to be cleft palate, yeah.
So yeah, I can definitely pull a stitch where he just puts his tongue in his nose, but just from the inside, if there was no hard palate.
Right, right.
Kind of gross.
Yeah, kind of gross, yeah. Kind of a nasty thought, right? So we know the tongue is an accessory organ. It is anchored to the bottom of your mouth by a set of connective tissues that we call the frenulum. If you go home and look in the mirror, you can see that strand of connective tissue, especially in the medial portion of your tongue, that connects your tongue to the bottom of your mouth. And some people are tongue-tied, and they actually can clip that frenulum, and that can make their tongue a little more loose in the mouth. So if you want to be loose in the tongue, then that frenulum can be snipped, okay? But normally it keeps our tongue anchored and prevents it from being, you know, too loose and too amenable in the mouth. Let's see, we've got teeth. Let's talk about those next. And of course, they're involved in mastication or chewing. how many baby teeth emerge between 6 months of age and around, say, 5 or 6 years of age?
20.
You're on the right track, 20, yep. So kids will have around 20 teeth emerge, and they are what we call baby teeth, milk teeth, or deciduous teeth. They are not permanent. They do fall out starting around age 5 or 6, and they may take into the middle teenage years to complete their falling out process. They're replaced by a set of teeth that are called permanent teeth. And how many permanent teeth maximum do you think we have?
32.
32, good. Some of us don't develop our third molars. Those third molars are called wisdom teeth. So if you have no third molars or wisdom teeth, or if you have them extracted, then you would only have 28 teeth total. Ooh, I bet they had to be taken out. Oh, wow. Wow. I imagine there was not room for those in the mouth, yeah. Two sets, yeah. Wow. Wow, I would hate to have that.
I don't know how they come. I mean, all of them were out.
Oh, wow. Must have had enough room in the back.
But they started hurting her as she got older.
So she had them taken out then? Wow. I imagine days before, like, modern dental surgery. I mean, could you imagine having, you know, two sets of wisdom teeth come in? Ouch. Yeah.
And imagine in her ear, you know, like...
Oh, yeah, that has to cause pain all back in that jaw area, yeah.
She used to have a vertigo bag, and I told her, that's what could be why.
Pushing on that inner, yeah, that middle inner ear, that's a very good reason, yeah. Why is a scary thought to have those wisdom teeth back that far? All right, so in terms of types of teeth, we have the front teeth that are considered to be incisors. These are the ones that you see when you smile. They are chisel-shaped, and they're meant to be able to cut and tear food. The canine teeth are actually cuspids. They are pointed. And then as we further go on back, we get into premolars, and then we get into the really flat, grinding molars. So we've actually got teeth that tear protein foods, and we've got teeth that grind plant foods. So we are built to handle both plant matter and animal matter in terms of the way our teeth are built. Let's see, in terms of a typical tooth structure, the hard outer surface is called what?
Enamel,
good. And that is covering dentin and pulp, which of course contains the root and blood vessels inside. The portion of the tooth that sticks up above the gum line that we can see is called the crown, yeah. So the crown is what you can see. And then what you can't see that's down below in the jawbone, that's the root, yeah. So of course, teeth are living. They do have a good blood supply. They do have a nerve supply. So as long as all that stuff is intact, you can feel pain and experience bleeding if that tooth happens to fall out. All right, dental hygiene program, there you are, 5 minutes time, okay? Any of y'all dental hygiene? Nobody's dental? One of you, okay. So related to teeth is salivary glands. So we kind of have to talk about these two together. It's very important that your salivary glands secrete saliva for the health of your teeth. What does saliva prevent your teeth from experiencing? Decay, yeah. So having a moist mouth with saliva can help prevent bacterial growth on your teeth and cavities from forming. So we don't necessarily think about these two portions going together, but both of these accessory glands are really important for the health of your teeth. There's hundreds of salivary glands scattered around the inside of your mouth. We just talk about the primary sets that are the largest salivary glands. We have a set called the parotid glands that are over your masseter muscle right in front of your ear. We also have a set underneath your tongue. They are called what?
Sublingual.
Sublingual, good. And how about the set up underneath your jaw?
That's submandibular.
Yeah, that's submandibular, good. So we also have other smaller ones scattered throughout the inside of our mouth, and the goal there is to secrete saliva to maintain, you know, moisture in the mouth, to prevent tooth decay, and of course saliva mixes with food to help break it down. So I know that you've probably had a bite, like we were talking saltines earlier. If you try to take a bite of food, especially dry food, with a dry mouth, that's very hard to get that stuff to chew up and swallow. So saliva is important for helping to moisten the food into a bolus that you push to the back of your mouth and consciously make the decision to swallow. All right, so taking a look at your worksheet, what does saliva contain? Yeah, a lot of water. Enzymes, yeah. One very important enzyme is called amylase. What does that break starches down into? Sugars. Good. Break starch down into sugars. If you want to do a really gross experiment, go home and take a piece of bread or a potato chip and hold it in your mouth for about 20 or 25 minutes. It'll start to taste sweet, yeah. Yeah, but it takes that long. It takes 20 to 25 minutes for you to actually have amylase fully break down the starch into sugar. Yuck. Yeah. So if you have little kids, sometimes you're bad about holding food in your mouth. Yeah, they may experience the transition, but not that they would know to tell you, right? But nonetheless, it takes that long to get the transition to occur.
They probably enjoyed it.
They probably do. I mean, this is like chewing gum, right? It's not. So the point is, if you don't fully break down starch in the mouth, there must be another organ that finishes the job for us. And that actually is the small intestine. So the mouth is just the beginning point for starting to break down that food. All right, so I wanted to mention mucin there. Mucin sounds like Mucinex, right? Mucin is actually the precursor to mucus. And if you happen to have a really dry mouth, your saliva is very thick like mucus. It takes water and moisture to dilute down that mucin and turn it into an active form that now becomes saliva. Normally when you feel mucin in your mouth, your saliva is very rubbery, it feels nasty to you, and you may not consciously have this conversation with yourself, but you probably have an urge to drink something to dilute down that mucin. So you probably never consciously think about this, it's just something that we automatically do when our saliva is really thick and rubbery. Notice what can activate salivation, you know, eating food, talking about food, smelling food. Those are things that can turn on the salivary process. Being nauseated can also activate salivation, lubricate the passage of food as it comes back up. Okay, and then of course spicy foods or, you know, an active parasympathetic nervous system can activate salivation. What impact do you think the sympathetic nervous system has on the salivary glands? Stop it, yeah, yeah. So if you're nervous and you're having to give a speech for speech class, you're going to probably have a dry mouth, right? So you can use the old trick of chewing on your tongue or chewing gum, and that'll help to activate salivation. Yep. Just don't bite tongue too hard, right? I just wanted to show you these pictures of salivary glands. You probably recognize that this is epithelial tissue. Do you see what specific type? It is cuboidal, right? And like other epithelial tissues, it is one that grows and regenerates quickly if needed. And the reason I make the point about this is there are such things as salivary cancers. You can have cancer form in these ducts in the salivary glands, and unfortunately, that can really weed its way into the structure of your face. I also had a student years ago who had salivary gland cancer. She had had some surgeries done to remove the salivary cancers, but at the point that she was in a class with me, she had no insurance and was delaying having the rest of the salivary gland cancer taken out. And she was in her early 20s. So it's, I believe, a slow-growing cancer, but nonetheless, you know, your head's full of important stuff. You wouldn't necessarily want cancer to travel to other tissues and invade. You may be able to see a small cyst on this right-hand side, actually anatomically left-hand side of the mouth, but nonetheless, that is a cyst down there that blocks the exit of one of those salivary glands. You can have salivary stones, just like you can have kidney stones, and if you salivate, they can block those glands. Anybody ever had that? Yeah. It is very painful, yeah. And this is another very important reason for having saliva. Tooth decay, like we talked earlier, so You know, if you are not producing enough saliva and you combine that with poor dental hygiene, then you have major tooth decay.
Okay, so you know, Aural and meth are like kind of the same, like the name.
Right.
Aural and meth.
Actually,
yeah. Well, if you are conscious of dental hygiene, then most likely not. Yeah, I think this is called a combination of low saliva production and
like extreme.
Yeah, and probably no care at all for their teeth. Yeah, that's probably the last.
I don't know if that just like happened.
Well, that like no brush teeth
in
their mouth.
Well, yeah,
like
they're,
you know,
it can be like
no brushing teeth. And meth is acidic. Combine that with no saliva, and you've got a recipe for disaster.
Oh,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was like, right, I had to go take my drug. So I didn't take my Adderall for like 5 days because I was like, I don't want them to take on meth.
I wonder if it would show up that way. That'd be interesting. I wonder if it would show up that way.
It does.
Oh, does.
I've got all the stuff.
Ah, okay.
I don't know if I told you the story, but when I went to the hospital, they gave me medication to lose weight. And then the dispensary, when I went to the hospital again for an emergency situation, they told me that I couldn't bring the dispensary with me because it was a controlled substance.
Really?
I'm
wow.
Like, what do you mean a controlled substance? It's mainly in his meth.
Really?
And
wow.
I immediately stopped that. And it's like, well, why would a doctor prescribe this?
Seriously.
So
that can travel from the crown down toward the root, and so it continues into periodontitis. So not only do they have tooth decay, but they probably have gum inflammation too. Yeah.
Well, they weren't
sacrificing
that feeling.
True.
Oh, that's the worst.
Yeah. We get MMR vaccines when we're kids. MMR has the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines in there, and there's, of course, a booster for that as you get a little older. And the goal is to prevent this particular virus that causes the mumps from getting into our systems. It tends to affect boys more severely than girls because it causes the testes to swell and can cause sterility for a boy who has the mumps. But you can see the massive swelling there around the neck. That comes from the swelling in those salivary glands. So you can imagine if you've ever eaten something really sweet and your salivary glands hurt as they inject saliva into your mouth, imagine how that would feel all the time with swollen salivary glands. Ooh. That had to be so painful. Those are some really sensitive areas. Yeah. All right, bottom of your page there, mouth functions include ingestion, which is just a fancy name for the process of eating. This is the first process that you do in terms of the digestive system, ingestion. Now, I'm not saying indigestion, right? Okay, so just putting it in your mouth and eating is ingestion. Mechanically, we grind up food using our teeth and tongue. We call that mastication. I'm sure you've heard all the jokes about masticating, right?
Mm-hmm.
Don't do it in public, you know. They told us this in high school and people are mortified, you know, like, do what? You know? Yeah, it's like so wrong. And then chemical digestion, we've got amylase that helps to break down our starches into simple sugars. So you can see there's not a whole lot of exciting things going on here. We're just chewing food into smaller, more manageable pieces so we can swallow it. And we barely begin the chemical breakdown process. So amylase actually begins what's called a hydrolysis reaction that breaks starches, polymers, into their building blocks of sugar. Math is pretty easy, right? Okay, any questions there? Y'all getting too hot? I think it's just, it's becoming part of the air.
Yeah.
That was really deep thoughts, wasn't it? All right, let's talk about the pharynx next. The pharynx is your throat, and when you swallow food, it has to pass from your mouth to your pharynx to your esophagus. And when you're chewing up food, I know you don't consciously think about this, but you actually do make a decision about pushing the food to the back of your mouth to be swallowed. You know, if you've ever had like really stringy cheese pizza, you may have decided I'm going to swallow this, and then you realize I'm going to get choked on it, and you try to pull it back. There's a certain time period that you can pull it back and still chew it that's under your conscious control, but when you start initiating the swallowing process and it goes too far back, it's gone, right? So you have to like gag it back up to get it back in your mouth. So, yeah, there's a conscious part of swallowing and a unconscious or involuntary part of swallowing. So pretty cool x-ray video here. They're actually showing somebody swallowing. You can see the epiglottis sticking up right about there. And we know that this anterior tube is the trachea. Yeah. Pretty cool. And then they're going to turn it, I believe, to the front and show you the anterior view in just a moment.
Yeah. Must have been noodles.
It's also a really small
spice.
It probably looks like
more
than
that. Yeah. It's like it's just a
whole chunk. Oh, did you?
Pretty good. Mm-hmm. Oh, it is. How did it get so liquidy?
I could just watch that all day. It's so relaxing. Hey, put that on as my like screensaver or something. Okay, so there's a voluntary portion of swallowing. It's called the buccal phase. There's an involuntary portion. It's called the pharyngeal esophageal phase. So when you're consciously deciding to swallow, that's that buccal phase. When you swallow, the pharyngeal esophageal phase takes over, and it's gone at that point. You have no further control after that point. Do notice that food is not traveling through the nasopharynx region. We only put food through the oro and laryngopharynx regions. You know, unless you're snorting food, it is not going through your nasopharynx. Okay, and the fancy name for swallowing is deglutition. It is partly under the control of skeletal muscles and partly under the control of smooth muscles. Deglutition. Deglutition is the name of this swallowing process. It's partly skeletal and partly smooth muscle control.
And that goes to the esophagus.
Yeah, that takes you down to the esophagus. The esophagus is just nothing but a food chute. It connects your pharynx to your stomach. It is lined with a multi-layered stratified squamous mucosa, and that is to help prevent the food from tearing away at the lining of your esophagus. These cells are replaced about every 2 to 3 weeks, so you know we're relying on mitosis here to maintain a healthy lining for your esophagus. You know, some cancer drugs are pretty vicious. They're pretty strong. And some of those cancer drugs slow down the mitosis rate in all cells of your body. Some side effects of cancer drugs involve like burning feeling and inflammation of the esophagus. Well, if you slow down the replacement process of these stratified squamous cells, then the food that travels down may tear away more at the lining of the esophagus. So I just wanted to mention that because some of those, I guess you'd call them more old style cancer drugs, tend to be pretty vicious in terms of how they affect the digestive system. And it's because we slow down the mitosis rates there.
Is that why cancer patients have like dry lips?
Probably. It probably affects how all those glands and those cells work, yeah. I just wanted to mention there is no serosa on the esophagus. It only has an innermost mucosa. The next layer would be called submucosa. And then the last layer is?
Muscularis
externa. So we're talking about the esophagus in your thoracic cavity, and there is no peritoneum in your thoracic cavity. The actual transition point between your esophagus and your stomach is tissue. And if you look at this picture, you'll notice that we're traveling along with stratified squamous, and then abruptly we all of a sudden switch and we now have a simple columnar lining for the inside of the stomach. That marks the actual time of transition between esophagus and stomach. That normally coincides with a sphincter that sits in the same area. What is the name of that sphincter? Cardiac sphincter, gastroesophageal sphincter. They call it lower esophageal sphincter, or LES for short. So at any rate, whatever you call that sphincter, it typically coincides, but not always, with that transition from stratified squamous into simple columnar. Okay. If you happen to have a piece of your stomach get pushed up above your diaphragm, you now have stomach acids that can gurgle back up into your esophagus. Even though the esophagus is made from stratified squamous, it doesn't have the really thick layer of mucus that your stomach has. So unfortunately, this can lead to a really bad condition called GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease. And what happens to your stomach lining, or your esophagus lining, when you start eroding it away with acid? Heartburn. Ulcers, yeah. Stuff that looks like this. Yeah, that looks pretty awful. So, yeah, even though it's stratified squamous, it needs the mucus to help protect from acid. That's why we're encouraged to, you know, not lay down after you eat, because those sphincters will open and food and acid can travel back up the esophagus. Of course, right? We just have to prop up in a recliner when we sleep. Make sure that gurgling doesn't happen. I just want to make a note here. On your worksheet, it says the esophagus has no digestive, all bold, all underlined, no digestive, and no absorptive role. The only job it has is to conduct food from your mouth and pharynx down to your stomach.
So it's just a pathway.
Just a pathway, yep. So as we pass through the hiatus, which is this opening here in the diaphragm, we are transitioning from what we call upper GI down into lower GI. So that diaphragm is kind of like the turning point between those two portions of our system. We get down into the stomach here and we have a big J-shaped pouch. This portion over here to the left actually hangs off to the left side of your abdominopelvic cavity. And when maximally full, you can actually force up to a gallon of food into your stomach. That's a lot of food that you can force in there. So routinely, if you eat really large meals, your stomach will learn to stretch however big you need it to be. So if you eat, say, several small meals a day, then you're going to get full more quickly than if you eat one big meal and stretch the heck out of your stomach.
Okay. My stomach is gone now.
Is it gone? Pulled it out? Oh, really?
It was a gastric sleeve.
Okay.
It's now like a laparoscopic surgery.
So okay.
They just cut off that whole part from the fundus. Like they leave like the cardia and like the part of the body that happens to go into the duodenum, but all the extra parts are gone.
Wow. Interesting to pull it out through your belly button.
I know.
What? Videos are even
cooler. Yeah, she said they pulled out.
Yeah, that's how, that was the fastest way that they could pull it out.
Oh my god. But I might get a hernia. No, it was a safe procedure, usually. Like, they make you do.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They make you do a diet beforehand, like at least 2 weeks, so that way you can make the size of your liver a lot smaller. Because you're not processing as much food, as much sugar. So the smaller the liver is, the easier it is for them to get through there through laparoscopic instead of just cutting it off.
Well, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Kind of an easy access point.
It is.
it hurt like that the first 5 days.
Oh, I bet that did. That's a sensitive area.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it was great.
Neat. Okay, so four regions of the stomach. We've got the cardio region that's closest to your esophagus. That is this region right around here. This portion that expands out is called?
Fundus.
Fundus, good. And when you eat a large meal, that's the part that can continue to expand and push. Down here we've got the body, main portion. And then what is the terminal end?
Pylorus.
Pylorus, good. So, you know, we were talking a minute ago about hiatal hernias and pushing a piece of the stomach up and above the diaphragm. Consistently eating large meals can increase your risk for doing a hiatal hernia, you know, herniating a piece of the stomach up. Unfortunately, pregnancy can also do it, and lifting heavy stuff can also do it. So, you know, there's some things you just can't avoid, really, and that unfortunately can herniate that piece of the stomach.
Okay, show me which part is the
cardia? Cardia is right around the esophagus, right around here.
Okay, so this is the cardiac sphincter.
Yeah, the cardiac sphincter is right in there.
Okay, so I'm right.
Right around that cardiac sphincter, right. Fundus is the part that expands.
Right, the curve, right?
Yeah, the curve. And then the main portion is the body. And the terminal ending down here is the pylorus. Okay. Okay, so that should take us to the bottom of 85. How about questions? Anything I need to clarify for you there?
So if you were giving us a quiz, telling us to name regions of the stomach, would you put airlines or just put something on there that says name this region?
I would probably, if I was doing fundus, I'd probably put a number like here, mm-hmm. or I'd put a number here.
Okay.
It'd be harder to do cardia because it's this general area around, like you said, that sphincter. Mm-hmm. And pyloric, I'd probably put a number down there.
Okay, well, I answered cardia, or no, it was fundus, but I put cardia.
Was it kind of.
Still, if like she just put names region up at the top of the thing.
So was it? Was there any marking down here?
No,
it was in the curve.
No,
it was in the curve.
Yeah, it was in the curve.
Over this way. I would, if it was over here toward the part that expands out, I'd probably say fundus.
Well, it was very specific.
Okay. See if she'll give you credit for fundus. If it's sitting kind of between the two.
No, it was
fundus.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
I'm just trying to get my points back.
Yeah,
like right here.
Well, it's not a damaged long region. Like right now.
That is a
fun. Yeah,
it is kind of closer to the fundus.
That is
the fundus. Yeah. It is in the middle. But the sphincter is like right up there.
Sphincter, yeah, like right there.
Yeah.
You need to be very specific. Speaking of sphincters, there are two that guard the openings of the stomach, and they're made up of the circular layer of muscularis externum. They are pressure regulated, so if pressure pushes on either side of those rings of muscle, they will open. That means food coming down from the esophagus will hit a ring of muscles there at the cardiac sphincter. They'll open, let food come through, and then they'll shut back. Mm-hmm. It works both ways, right? Mm-hmm. If you're really full and food hits the bottom side of your cardiac sphincter, or comes up in your mouth, right? Mm-hmm. So.
I had that issue with both. That's, I'm sorry. Like, when I first got the surgery and I was finally able to eat solid food, mm-hmm. I didn't realize how much solid food I can have at a time.
How little you could have.
Well, yes, exactly. And so when I had like a sandwich, literally like after the game.
Because you just had no room down there.
Right.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Ouch. That pyloric sphincter is only going to open and give about a teaspoon's worth of food over to your small intestine at a time. That's why it takes so long for your stomach to empty, because that pyloric sphincter is not like a bathtub drain. It just doesn't open and let all the food exit. It opens and only lets very small amounts of food go into your small intestine. That takes 4 to 6 hours to complete.
So wasn't a person indigestion and what heartburn?
I think they're pretty much the same. Extra gas production, extra acid production, stomach ache. We oftentimes think of those kind of all together.
Like to me, whenever I think of like heartburn or acid reflux, like I think of like burn. But when I think of indigestion, like whenever I consider like burn.
I think it's all the same. I think it's coming past that cardiac sphincter up into the esophagus. And if it burns, you can probably say heartburn. But like you say, indigestion, it's still coming up past that sphincter.
Yeah. So why do they say it takes however many hours for food poisoning to... Cause is that because it has to get into the small intestine before it can...
Because you're looking at 4 to 6 hours in the stomach and 3 to 6 hours in the small intestine. So there's some time delay.
Affects the medulla, right?
Yes.
So you have to get the bloodstream and everything first before.
That's right.
You could even know you had it.
Okay. Yeah. Because I was in the airport and I had like Java juice or something, and it didn't hit me until like 6 hours later, and I'm like,
perfect.
But I felt like crap that whole time, but I didn't throw up for like 6 hours.
Wishing probably that you could throw up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's about the perfect time for it to hit the small intestine.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it takes about 6 hours for it to reach?
4 to 6. Yeah, for something to fully get into your bloodstream.
I was going to ask, how long does it take to go from mouth to stomach?
Seconds. In terms of swallowing, liquid takes 1 to 2 seconds. A solid piece may take, I think, 3 to 6 seconds to hit your stomach.
Another random question. You know how you swallow something that
gets
stuck? Is it actually stuck or is it
digested? You can have a spasm in the esophagus. You can have two circular muscles clamp around a piece of food in between, and you have to wait for this one to open for the food to go down. And for sometimes, sometimes it's just a few seconds, but in other cases, that spasm may last 30 minutes or longer. Yes.
Or like if you try to swallow a pill and you don't have to.
Oh, you feel it going,
like it's sideways.
Yeah. It may in fact just be that you need to flush it with fluids, but they say that women are more likely to have that spasm where it gets shut and closed than men are.
That's what most people do. Good.
Yeah. Drink, 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 get it down, yeah. You only see rugae when your stomach is empty. You don't see the rugae when you're full because, of course, your stomach stretches. But these rugae just increase the surface area inside your stomach. That's why they appear when you're empty. And I know that in lab you guys are studying all these other parts. I just wanted to mention, this is not in the course pack, but yeah, you've got that fatty apron that covers down over the lower digestive organs. Good, greater omentum.
Now, is that just to keep them, like, tucked in?
Yeah. It's insulation, yeah. And you've probably heard them talk about visceral fat, on TV and whatnot.
Yeah.
That's the visceral fat because it covers those organs. There's also another omentum that hangs from the lesser curvature that covers the liver, but it's harder to see in this picture.
The lesser omentum
what? Lesser omentum hangs from the liver and part of the stomach. Yeah, it comes off. Yeah, we can't really see it there.
So for this class, we don't really need to know that much about the
omentum? Not for lecture, no. And all you need to do is identify it for lab. So it looks like we're ready to get into a gastric pit, which there are hundreds of inside your stomach's lining. This is our next topic. It's microscopic structures and secretion that occurs in your gastric pits. The first type of cell that I want to introduce you to is called an enteroendocrine cell. Entero means intestine, or digestive, okay? And then endocrine, of course, we know what that means. That means we're going to release hormones. So these enteroendocrine cells release numerous hormones, but the one we're going to focus on is called gastrin. And this particular hormone is going to change the environment inside your stomach. In fact, if I start talking about your favorite foods, we can actually turn on gastrin production. So, if you could have anything at all to eat for lunch today, what would it be?
Pizza.
Chicken salad.
Chick-fil-A. Chicken salad.
Sweet potatoes.
Sweet potatoes. Oh, that sounds good. Pasta. Comfort foods, right? Okay.
We're stuck here.
So when you start thinking about what you want to eat, you actually turn on gastrin production thanks to the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve is connected to your brain, and when you start thinking about what I'm going to have for lunch that sounds really good, the vagus nerve tells your stomach that, hey, food's coming. They're talking about food. So, yeah. So if you're not normally hungry in the next hour or so, you might, in fact, have a growling stomach today.
So what is actually growling?
It's air that's being pushed into your duodenum from your stomach, and there's less space, so the air in there is rumbling around.
So it's like,
burp it out, and the growling will stop.
Burp it out?
Yeah. Well, if you don't burp it out, it's coming out the other end. Yeah.
Like, so it's trying to push something, but it only has air.
That's right. That's right.
And that's why it's like, oh, your stomach's growling, you must be hungry.
Yeah. And it's probably grinding gastric juices with that air, and it's propelling it toward your pyloric sphincter, and then just... there comes the noise. Yeah, it comes back a little bit and then forward, so. Yeah.
So is that like a natural process to be like, hey, maybe eat something, or is that just because that's the way the stomach works?
Both. Partly it is a sign that you're hungry, but then of course the air in there is something you can get. Yeah. So gastrin is our hormone that helps to turn on stomach secretions. You'll notice that it goes to your parietal cells, and those parietal cells now secrete hydrochloric acid. Hydrochloric acid, well, is an acid, right? And that makes the pH in your stomach around 1 or 2. Now, let me tell you, that is such strong acid, it can decay your teeth. Okay, so if you happen to gurgle it up, no wonder the esophagus looks like Swiss cheese. And if it comes to your mouth, it can actually erode away your tooth enamel. Yeah, brush your teeth, right?
That's why people with eating disorders have that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, because that constant acid will erode your teeth away. Mm-hmm. So, the gastrin turns on acid. Acid is going to start preparing the stomach environment for food to come. So, if we start talking about food again, gastrin starts getting made. Gastrin turns on hydrochloric acid. Hydrochloric acid comes from these parietal cells. And of course, that's going to prepare the environment, make it very acidic, and ready for food to come. Notice it also that we have something called gastrin-inhibiting peptide. It's called GIP for short. That can shut off gastrin production after a meal is over. So, you know, when you're done eating and your stomach's full and you've left the table, GIP will actually shut off gastrin production. Now, what do you think GIP does to your stomach's pH? Raises it back up, right? So if you're coming back up to like say a 3 or a 4, you're coming up higher, then you're now no longer prepared to digest those foods. All right, so if you go ahead.
So the mucuses and stuff that are in your stomach, that's what's preventing the acid from eating through?
That's right. And the esophagus doesn't have the mucus, so that's why the acid eats the esophagus. Yeah, it must be some really thick stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so if you think it, you turn on your parasympathetic nervous system. That turns on your vagus nerve. The vagus nerve turns on those enteroendocrine cells. They release a hormone called what?
Gastrin.
Gastrin tells your parietal cells time to release an acid. That acid makes the pH in your stomach around 1 or 2. What else does your parietal cell release? Actually, intrinsic factor. Yeah, those parietal cells release intrinsic factor. You'll notice that intrinsic factor is actually required for vitamin B12 absorption. This is going to take us full circle back to the blood chapter. Vitamin B12 is important there to make red blood cells. Okay, so that's your blank. Vitamin B12 is important to make red blood cells. And there's a form of anemia that we can form when there's inadequate levels of B12. What type of anemia?
Pernicious.
Pernicious, good. And if you need the spelling for that one, it's P-E-R-N. I-C-I-O-U-S. So let's think about some issues here. If you happen to be having, say, gastric bypass surgery and the piece of your stomach is removed, or gastric sleeve or lap band surgery, and we reduce the amount of intrinsic factor that your stomach can make and influence, then we of course reduce B12, and now we have to be concerned about pernicious anemia. So you kind of think about stomach activity and you think, you would never think, hey, that has something to do with my blood cells, but in fact that can make you very tired and anemic from having part of your stomach removed. So interesting relationship there. That's right, to keep your energy levels up, right? Let's see, another thing that we're going to look at are cheese cells. Those cheese cells release an inactive enzyme called pepsinogen. And the gen suffix is a great clue. What does gen tell us? Gen means to make, grow, build, yeah. Generate, that's good. What type of pH do you need to convert pepsinogen into active pepsin?
Acidic.
Good. So if you're hungry and you're thinking about food and your gastrin tells your parietal cells to release hydrochloric acid then turns pepsinogen into pepsin. And now pepsin is ready to break down what particular food group?
Proteins.
Good. Okay, so if you're thinking about food, let's say that we want a steak for lunch because that's protein, then what happens is your vagus nerve tells your gastrin to be produced by enteroendocrine cells. Then gastrin is going to help us make parietal cells release more of that hydrochloric acid. Once you've got hydrochloric acid in your stomach, you can now convert pepsinogen from your cheese cells into an active form called pepsin. And when you have meat like steak, you can now use pepsin to break that down into amino acids. Yep. Sometimes people take those proton pump inhibitor drugs like Prilosec and Nexium, and they advertise those drugs to help reduce the acid reflux and the acid production in the stomach. And, you know, they say that every medication has pros and cons. Well, of course, if you've got acid reflux, you can reduce it using one of those drugs. The con, the bad part of it is, if you reduce acid production in your stomach, what now do you also influence? Yeah, protein digestion, exactly. So, you know, there's always something that comes as a negative of a medication, and that just happens to be the downside of taking something like one of those proton pump inhibitors. All right, so then we've got mucous neck cells that produce thick layers of mucus. We have renin, notice that one's spelled with two N's, that helps us to break down milk proteins. If any of you have had little kids or little siblings, you may have noticed when they were babies that when they drank milk and vomited it back up, that they may in fact have had, they're my fingers off, they may in fact have had something that looks kind of like cottage cheese that they were throwing up, and that is the action of renin. A lot of times people think that the kid has a sour stomach, but renin actually breaks milk proteins into something that looks a little bit like cottage cheese, which, not to make you sick, is how they make cottage cheese. They use enzymes to break down milk proteins. So, yeah, it's not like throw up, but the concept is the same. Kind of like sour cream too, yep. All right, so at the bottom of your page, let me fill in those blanks for you. All right, vagus nerve triggers the release of gastrin. That's your blank down there in summary. The vagus nerve turns on gastrin. Gastrin tells those parietal cells to release on the left, hydrochloric acid. First blank is gastrin. Gastrin tells your parietal cells to make and release, on the left, hydrochloric acid, or HCl. And on the right side, their intrinsic factor. Now we know that hydrochloric acid is important for helping us transform blank into blank. Yeah, pepsinogen into pepsin. Hydrochloric acid helps us transform pepsinogen into pepsin. Now on the right hand side, we need intrinsic factor for the absorption of vitamin what?
B12.
Good. And we'll pick back up on the bottom of this page on Tuesday.